Hi, good. Hello. Sorry, I'm a little caught off balance because my Skype just crashed and now I'm back. But anyway, hi, welcome everybody. Welcome to our special Halloween edition of the Tolkien Professor Chat here. We're going to have a little bit of a roundtable discussion here tonight. I have been soliciting topics of discussion from listeners through my Facebook page and my Twitter feed, and have gotten a whole bunch of very interesting things that people want to talk about. Lots of wraiths and ghosts and monsters and things that people would love to hear us talk about here on Halloween. I thought I would start. Well, though, but I thought first I would ask our live guests here. We're here with Dave Kale, who is our host here at Middle-earth Network Radio, and with Laura Burkholz, who is not only my excellent and erstwhile producer, but also both Laura and Dave, of course, are veterans of the Silmarillion Seminar. So I just wanted to ask if either of you two had things that you would really like to talk about first on the Tolkien and horror or Halloween theme.
I do,
All
actually.
right.
I'd love if you could talk about the vampire whose name I can't really pronounce, Thuring Withil.
Thuringwethil, yes, Thuringwethil.
Thuringwethil. And also Sarn's Isle of Werewolves, which
Yes.
so if you could talk about those things, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, the vampire one I can talk about fairly briefly, I'm afraid, and I fear disappointingly, because although there are vampires mentioned a couple times, and Thuringwethil is even a named vampire, I think it's relatively clear from looking at the ways in which Tolkien is using these things that he doesn't actually mean vampire in the Dracula sense at all. When Tolkien uses the word vampire, he seems always to mean a vampire bat.
Oh, that's too bad.
No, it's Thuringwethil was a bat. I mean, she's a named bat, and she seems to be a sentient bat. I mean, she seems to be a monstrous bat, and that's interesting. But she's not a vampire. She's definitely not a vampire in the Drod Vlakul sense, or Vlad Dracul, I switch it around, in the Vlad Dracul sense of the term. So, and we can see this Tolkien using that word in that way. That is the word vampire to mean a vampire bat. Very clearly, when he's talking about mere bats, for instance, in The Hobbit, he uses the word vampire. When the cloud of bats accompanies the goblins and wargs to the Battle of Five Armies, and he alludes to the bats fastening themselves vampire-like on the stricken, and that is like
Oh.
vampire bats. So,
Well,
go ahead.
if that woman was able to take a bat shape and act like a vampire bat, doesn't that kind of make her a vampire if she's drinking blood?
Yes, but I think that it basically, I don't see any evidence that Tolkien was appealing to what we in the 20th century would call standard vampire mythology. You know,
So
like,
she's not an allegory for Count Dracula then.
no, definitely
Allegorical
not.
figure.
No, and I mean, like, the whole, like, you know, the connection between vampires and the dead, and I mean, all of this, like, basically the post Bram Stoker stuff, he doesn't seem to be invoking that stuff at all. I mean, his works are all, I mean, Tolkien's works are all post Bram Stoker, of course. Dracula was published in 1897, but and it was terrifically popular. I'd be surprised if he didn't know Dracula, but he certainly doesn't seem to have been very interested or influenced by that. So I don't think we're supposed to be thinking about the dead at all when he talks about vampires, which is sad, but I know it's disappointing on Halloween, but there it is. I think it's vampire bats. The werewolves, though, there are legitimate werewolves.
I ask one more question about
Sure.
vampires?
Oh
How far back do the ideas of vampires go? That's
Oh, you mean
like
historically?
folklore tales and
Oh,
stuff like
yes.
that, but
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, it sort of depends on what level you're talking about. Like, the concept of the vampire is certainly very old. And there are stories, and also quite global. I mean, there are, you know, ancient Chinese stories of, you know, the dead rising to suck blood and things, but really, at the end of the day, for all practical purposes, you're really talking about Bram Stoker. I mean, Dracula was a phenomenon like few other books have ever been a phenomenon. I was going to, if Travis were here, I would say, just to rile him up, that, like, you know, Harry Potter is as nothing as a literary phenomenon compared to Dracula. But there's no point saying it now because Travis isn't here. But anyway, no, I mean, it was enormous. There were vampire stories out there, but it was not mainstream. This is actually, I love Dracula, and I teach Dracula in my English 101 class all the time at Washington College. And when I teach Dracula, one of the things that I always, you know, talk about with the students, I'm like, when you read this, you somehow have to try to distance yourself from all the things you know or think you know about vampires. And, you know, for the sake of trying to understand some of the way that this novel works, try to put yourself in the position, it's like, to realize that the people reading this, by and large, had no idea. I mean, it was just not in the cultural view of, you know, of modern people, before Bram Stoker. I mean, it was so far outside the cultural mainstream that although the identity of Count Dracula, like what Count Dracula really is, you know, that is this undead thing, this immortal undead thing that sucks blood. What he was supposed to be, it was supposed to be a mystery. I mean, the characters are figuring it out and sort of slowly stumbling to the horrible realization of the truth of what he is. And yet, the name, the fake name that that Bram Stoker originally gave to Dracula was not Dracula. His name was going to be Count Vampire. Like one peer, you know, with a Y instead of an I. I mean, but like that wasn't even going to give it away to anybody. Like it was still going to be a mystery as to what he was because that word meant nothing to anybody. And then Bram Stoker stumbled across the legends of Vlad the Impaler and loved it to death, and you know, and the vampire became Dracula. But anyway, it's so although the idea of vampires had been around for a really long time, it was pretty fringe culturally, and it really never got into like it to being a really popular and mainstream idea until Bram Stoker.
Do you think Tolkien used the word vampire from the Bram Stoker books, or do you think he was thinking of these old folk tales from way back?
I don't think. I mean, because. Because of these folk tales, vampire bats were already called that. So I really think Tolkien was just thinking about vampire bats. I mean, I know it's, I mean, and if you think about it, in the context of the mythology that Tolkien is creating, the vampire bat works really perfectly. The vampire bats were the messengers of Sauron. You know, Sauron, who was in the First Age, the lieutenant of Morgoth. They had bats. The bats of Sauron were were the only flying creatures who were allied with Morgoth. They were the only evil flying creatures because, of course, as we all know, Balrogs don't have wings. So, the bats were the only things that flew, but they were kind of the evil, you know, parallel to the eagles. They were pretty lame, really, compared to the eagles. And the eagles could, it was the, there was there could be no fight in between them. But you know, as a winged messenger, to have this, you know, parasitic blood-sucking thing as his winged messengers, that seemed really appropriate, you know. So again, it's not about the reanimated dead. It's about the bats,
Yeah.
basically. And so Thorin Gwethil was a giant bat, and that's why Luthien, when Luthien puts on her skin, which is gross, she becomes a giant bat and flies along next to Beren, who has put on the hame of Draugluin, that is the pelt, the skin of Draugluin, the wolf, and they morph into wolf and bat and proceed thus up to Thangorodrim to knock on Morgoth's door. So
So I'm going to jump in. I want to introduce one of our two special guests tonight. So George Naylor, who's a regular now on the Hogshead Pubcast, is actually on our Skype call right now, and he's a huge Tolkien fan. And when he heard we were talking horror and Tolkien, he was like, oh, I'd love to be a part of that. So George, welcome.
Hi, thanks for letting me jump in on this.
George, tell me some about your interests in Tolkien. Did you have any particular sort of thoughts or angles or things that you would want to talk about in the issue of Tolkien and horror and monsters and things like that?
Well, I've read through the various comments on the Tolkien Professor page on Facebook, and I'm noticing a lot of comments on Barrow-wites and Ringwraiths, yes, and also ghosts as well, especially how that would have fit into Tolkien's Catholic viewpoint, the ghosts especially, with the Aragorn and the Paths of the Dead,
yes,
aspect of it. I think in Tolkien it seems like these spirits or ghosts are more have a power over the mortal rather than those who are immortal, like Legolas in the Paths of the Dead doesn't really care about all the ghosts that are following, while Gimli as a dwarf who was also mortal would feel that fear. So I think I'm not sure where that's going, but it seems to be a definite kind of theme there, especially like the elves who have been in the Undying Lands with the light of the two trees, and as Tolkien says, they kind of live in both worlds,
yes,
both that spiritual and the physical plane. So I don't know how that fits in with horror per se. It certainly people are saying, well, they're spooky and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the ghosts. The Ghosts in the Paths of the Dead, it's really the only place in The Lord of the Rings where we get any actual ghost story itself. And, and I think there, as far as Catholic stuff is concerned, mostly, I guess I would say, I don't think it necessarily really comes into the question all that much, because it doesn't really have anything to do with, like, the ultimate fate of anybody's soul.
Right.
You know, what we see in the ghosts is, I think, related to what we see in the Ringwraiths, which is the connection of people. Like, okay, people become Ringwraiths, just as Gandalf explains to Frodo that, you know, Gollum and Bilbo and eventually he himself are going to be like on these, you know, at different stages of the wraithification process, right? And what appears to happen is when the spirit is kind of attenuated, the spirit is kept, but the body, you know, the body is fading, the body dies away, and eventually they become wraiths. It is their spirits are kind of kept. With the Ringwraiths, it was about immortality. It was about achieving immortality, about cheating death, about escaping death, and achieving in the end power over death, which of course, with the kind of irony usually found in Tolkien's moral world, meant actually being a slave to death. But they wanted to escape. So they drew out their life so long. Remember Bilbo's comment about feeling like butter scraped over too much bread, right? You know, the metaphor that I've used before is, you know, that Tolkien seems to be kind of appealing to the idea that the medieval idea that basically a human being at birth is given a certain quantity of life. You know, their spirit kind of lasts so long, and the famous and kind of delightful metaphor that Chaucer uses for this is a beer barrel that that, you know, like a human soul when it's born, like a human when it is born is like a beer barrel that's all, you know, that's all full. And of course different people have different size beer barrels, you know, people have different life allotments due to them, but anyway, you know, the guy, and then, you know, the tap is running throughout life, the beer is flowing out of the barrel, and then when you get to the bottom of the barrel, that's it, you're done. And basically the reason that Bilbo is feeling thin and stretched is that, you know, the tap is still running, but it's basically like the beer's being watered down to to keep it coming, and that, you know, that he's being spread thin. His life is being stretched out unnaturally over a much longer space than it was actually allotted for, but he doesn't get any more life. His life force doesn't increase, it just gets stretched over more time. And this ultimately is what we see happen. This is why the Ringwraiths have lost their corporeality entirely. Their body's gone, their spirits remain, still cling to this existence, but it is so attenuated and it's so sort of cheapened in this way that all they have is this shadowy enslaved existence, and they don't even really have wills of their own. They don't even really have wills of their own anymore. They're just the slaves of their master. So, and Gollum is on the way there. He's not there yet, but he's further down that road. And I think that the ghosts in the Paths of the Dead are in a similar kind of position. It's not like the Wraiths. It's not the rings that are stretching them out. But, you know, with them, the thing which has made them outstay their time is the curse of Isildur, who curses them for breaking their oaths. And that's an interesting thing. But curses like that very often have power in Tolkien. I mean, you know, when somebody administers a curse, especially someone of the kind of stature of Isildur, that tends to stick. And it certainly does in Isildur's case. And that's why they cannot go. But that's why when they fulfill their oath and the curse is lifted, then they just vanish.
Right.
You know, because their spirits then finally go to wherever it is that human souls go, outside the circles of the world.
You know, one thing that the ring raids bring up, call to mind to me is, so one thing, I'm actually not extremely well read in general, but in particular on gothic horror stuff. But from listening to Travis's podcast, I believe he's emphasized several times that sort of a classic gothic villain theme is the desire to overcome death, but sort of in the unhealthy way. And I think there's actually something very interesting going on here with the Ringwraiths and Voldemort from Harry Potter. Dracula is sort of one of those undead gothic villains, which I think is very interesting. I don't know where I'm going with that other than just pointing
Well, no,
out.
I mean, in that way, you know, certainly the Ringwraiths are the natural extension of that. I mean, the thing that drives Voldemort to make the Horcruxes is ultimately, you know, the central thing that leads the Ring. I mean, they desire power, and they get, you know, the rings of power that they're given give them power to dominate others. But in the end, with these humans, just like with the Numenoreans who are corrupted by Sauron, in the end, it's always about death. And it's always about power over death and escaping from death. You know, Voldemort is like, you know, living Ar-Pharazôn's dream, right?
Yes.
Or, you know, thinks he is. and that's you know, so certainly that theme is pretty consistent. Now with Dracula, it's a little bit different in that we're not given. This is one of the things that you see always in Dracula movies. One of the things that I've never seen a Dracula movie that didn't take this step that the book doesn't take, which is to give Dracula a rationale. Like they want to explain why, like what led Dracula to become a vampire. The book doesn't give any hint of it. And, you know, he's never, but of course, when it's given, you know, sometimes for vengeance, sometimes for desire for immortality or whatever, that desire isn't there in the book. That is Dracula's own motivation. But certainly that escape from death is one of the things where we do see it in the book is in Renfield. Renfield is the character right. In the book who is the mouthpiece of that desire for life and that desire to escape death. Renfield is the Ar-Pharazôn figure in Dracula, except he's much cooler. I love Renfield. He's my favorite character in Dracula. But
interesting.
But yeah, certainly that desire to escape death is, I mean, that's, you know, as Tolkien said, that basically, you know, mortality and immortality is, you know, he says at one point that it is the primary theme of The Lord of the Rings. But people sometimes quote that, but what they don't quote is what he says immediately afterwards, which is to say it was written by a man. That is, like, you know, all humans have this, you know, deep-rooted fascination in issues of, like, life, death, and mortality, and that, you know, he kind of argues very briefly in about one sentence that, you know, all human stories in one way or another come down to that. So when he says that about the Lord of the Rings, he's saying it in that context. But certainly it was something that he was interested in that way. But that actually is kind of one of the things that I think is interesting, that other than the Ringwraiths, we don't see that in a lot of other places. That is, we don't see that desire for immortality. He doesn't go there with vampires. And you know, with many of his other monsters, we don't see that same kind of thing.
He embeds it in, he doesn't embed it in monsters, he embeds it in humans.
Right.
Which is really fascinating.
Exactly. Yeah. They're the ones who have the problem with it. More of the monsters kind of know where they are. The Oathbreakers, the ghosts, they don't want immortality. They want freedom from it. They want to get rid of it. They never wanted it in the first place, so far as we can tell. But the Ringwraiths, they did want it, and now they've got it. The Barrow-wights, they're in a different situation, and I think have a different kind of origin. But it's complicated. The Barrow-wights are complicated. We should probably talk about Barrow-wights because that was the number one most requested issue, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which, understandably, the Barrow-wights are pretty Halloween-ish. They're pretty spooky.
That's true. And just that scene is very Halloween-ish. We were talking on the Hogshead podcast earlier about how one of the classic gothic elements is claustrophobia and sort of gothic spaces. Yes. And so you totally see that in the Barrow.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the first thing to point out is that is first of all what the word means, that is what Barrow-white means. And this, like most of Tolkien's names derived from English and Anglo-Saxon, is terrifically disappointing. The word white just means person. It's a very generic word. It's a Middle English word, which just means, like, it's literally a common noun that poets like Chaucer and stuff use when they use it like the word guy, you know, like some wicht, or like anybody, you know, like any wicht. I mean, it's like the word wicht. It just means a person. It doesn't even necessarily mean a human person. So when Pippin, for instance, says to Beregond, when Beregond in Minas Tirith comments on the fact that Pippin has a sword which was carved by the men of Numenor, and wonders if he will tell him the story of where he got it, and Pippin is like, no, I really don't want to. I'm still kind of freaked out about that. What he says that, like, it came out of the mounds that are near his country, but evil wights live there. He just means, like, evil dudes live there. I mean, like, the Barrow-wights, the name. But again, this is what Tolkien usually does. I mean, like, you know, the Maiaris, the name of the special breed of horses. The word Maiaris in Anglo-Saxon means horses, right? Edoras, the city of the Rohirrim. The word Edoras in Anglo-Saxon means buildings or town.
So,
you know,
is white one of those words that because of the way Tolkien uses it, we've now incorporated this meaning into it? Because you see it all over the place now, meaning ghost.
Yep, absolutely it is. And that, I think, also, like, from Tolkien through Dungeons and Dragons, yes. It's one of the ways. I mean, there are so many things Dungeons and Dragons and other modern fantasy stories and games and things like that have just sort of lifted vocabulary straight from Tolkien, and sometimes, like, lifted synonyms and treated them as if they're different, like subspecies of monsters and stuff like that. when really they're just synonyms, but whatever. Yes, it was like the Barrow Whites,
like orcs and goblins, you mean?
Like orcs and goblins, exactly. Or yeah, exactly. So it's white was just, it was a completely, it had no preternatural connotations at all in Old and Middle English.
I love the chat rooms now renamed Barrel Whites to Tomb Dude.
Tomb Dude, yeah, exactly. That's right. Grave guy. The grave guys.
Unbelievable. Yeah. That's hilarious. Guy, George R. R. Martin uses white to mean, well, actually, I guess he's using it sort of vaguely, too. We don't really know what he's talking about and the things that are beyond the wall in the north or whatever.
Right,
but he
right.
definitely is using the term white, I believe.
Yeah. No, but there's definitely, they're definitely sort of whites in the, like, creepy undead sense.
They're not just the guys on the other side of the wall.
Right. They're not just the guys on the other side of the wall. They're like the walking dead guys on the other side of the wall. Yeah, exactly. So that's sort of the first thing about Barrow Whites, which is really kind of a small thing. A couple things that I would want to kind of go to the text a little bit because it's a little bit complicated. Here is the very brief, indeed one sentence description that we get from Tom Bombadil about the Barrow Whites and how they started. This is in the paragraph on page 128 in my trade paperback editions when Tom Bombadil is giving like a brief history of the world, or at least of his little bit of the world that he's lived in forever. He talks about, let's see, in the middle of the paragraph he says, there were fortresses on the heights, kings of little kingdoms fought together, and the young sun shone like fire on the red metal of their new and greedy swords. Here he is referring to the civil wars in the North Kingdom of Arnor, when it was in decline and had split up into three kingdoms, which were fighting against each other. So things are already going rapidly downhill for the North Kingdom of Arnor, which is, of course, where Tom Bombadil's little postage stamp size domain that he's claimed for himself is. Gold was piled on the biers of dead kings and queens, and mounds covered them, and the stone doors were shut, and the grass grew over all. Sheep walked for a while, biting the grass, but soon the hills were empty again. So now the kingdoms, the Dúnedain kingdoms, are done, and you know the whole place is abandoned. So we've got now just the Dúnedain chieftains kind of wandering around, and no settlements. Then, okay, a shadow came out of dark places far away, and the bones were stirred in the mounds. Barrow Whites walked in the hollow places with a clink of rings on cold fingers and gold chains in the wind. The clink of rings on cold fingers sometimes leads people to wonder if there are actually like rings of power involved in any way. I don't think so. Because of course you'll notice they don't only have rings, they have gold chains. That just like, it's just the treasure, I think, that we're talking about here. The gold, remember the gold that was piled on the biers of dead kings and queens. So a shadow came out of dark places far away, and the bones were stirred in their mounds. This is the chief difference in why the Barrow Whites are fundamentally different from the Ringwraiths. The Ringwraiths are tortured and attenuated human spirits whose lives have been stretched out centuries past where they should have been, and until all that's left is an enslaved wraith ghost thing. The Barrow Whites are dead bodies which have been animated by dark spirits which have come into the mounds from outside. And they come in with the evil influence that comes to the area. They're kind of sent there to stir up trouble.
Are these sort of dark spirits in the same sense of dark spirits coming in inhabiting monsters in the Silmarillion?
Yes, I think so. I mean, there's clearly a wide range of spirits. That is, there's more than just, you know, there's the Valar, there's the Maiar. Maiar is a pretty general and vague terms, but there's also, and this was much clearer in Tolkien's earlier conceptions of his mythology. He would talk about, like, the people of Manwë, for instance, who were the spirits generally associated with the air. And in his first writings in the Book of Lost Tales and stuff, Tolkien used a lot of the traditional terms, things like sylphs and pixies and brownies and things like that, and he would put them with the appropriate Valar that ruled over the realm that they were associated with, whether it was the air or the earth or things like that. So some of those spirits who are associated with the Valar are pretty minor spirits, like sylphs and brownies and things like that, or those who will come to be called sylphs and brownies by people later on. Now, Morgoth, of course, also has his people, spirits of this kind, minor spirits of this kind, and so these spirits, these minor league spirits, are ones who will inhabit the spirits of monsters. That seems to be what the werewolves are. That was probably what Thurin Gwethil was. She was a sentient bat, which I don't think just means like a bat so highly developed that she has developed sentience and free will and everything like that. She is also one of these spirits which has invested in animal form. And the werewolves are clearly like that too. I don't think the werewolves are werewolves in the Anthony Hopkins sense. They're werewolves that is human beings which have caught a disease called lycanthropy and therefore turn into wolves. Those, there are many legends about those. There was a quite famous medieval story, one of Marie de France's lays called Bisque la Vraie, which just means werewolf in old French, about a guy who, this noble who had this dark secret, which is that he used to go out and turn into a wolf every now and again, blow off some steam. But anyway, so I don't think they're werewolves in the sense of human beings, which sometimes either are privileged to or cursed to turn into wolves, but rather they're these evil spirits who invest the form of wolves, like Sauron does. Sauron becomes a werewolf when he fights and is tromped by Huon and Luthien in the story of Luthien Tenuviel. So I think that those are the same order of spirits. Also, probably the same things which are in dragons and stuff. Anyway, that they come in and they take over dead bodies. Now, the interesting thing, I think, is the complicated thing with the Barrow-wights is exactly what connection, if any, is there between the Barrow-wights and the dead people whose graves and bodies they appear to, to inhabit.
I was going to ask that because
that's something that always confused me. I mean, I think I've got it straight now, but I know it wasn't clear to me when I read it for the first few times who they actually were.
Yeah.
Because they seem to have, well, I guess they could just know things about them, but they seem to possess memories.
Yes. Well, by far the most puzzling moment of all of this is Merry's memory when he wakes up from his dream.
Yes.
Right.
That's the moment that puzzles many. Verlin Flieger loves this moment. It's like one of her favorite moments in The Lord of the Rings. When Mary wakes up,
not surprised.
She's commented on this a couple of
times. Now it's one of my favorite moments.
Yeah, I agree.
I know, Laura. You're like Verlin Flieger's number one fan.
I am. I really am.
I know. So this is, of course, is on page 140 of Fellowship of the Ring when Merry wakes up and he says, "What in the name of wonder?" began Merry, feeling the golden circlet that had slipped over one eye. Then he stopped and a shadow came over his face and he closed his eyes. "Of course, I remember," he said. "The men of Carn Doom came on us at night and we were worsted. Ah, the spear in my heart." He clutched at his breast. No, he said, opening his eyes. "What am I saying? I've been dreaming. Where did you get to, Frodo?" In other words, he has what appears to be the memory of the guy whose tomb he was Inn, who was one of the nobles of the Dúnedain, who was, because we know that he was one of the good guys. It's not one of the bad guys whose memories he has, because he talks about fighting the men of Carn Dûm, which is the capital of the Witch King of Angmar. So he was one of the good guys who was fighting against the Witch King, and he remembers getting stabbed by a spear and dying. Now, but again, the complicated thing is, how does that connect with the Barrow White himself? And I don't think it suggests that the Barrow White has those memories necessarily, that he himself is, in any sense, that dead Dúnedain who was buried in that tomb.
Yeah, I think that I thought that the Barrow Whites were actually perhaps the men of Carn Dûm who would also have been killed in that battle. Is that correct?
Well, it's possible, but see, they wouldn't be buried there because these were the barrows of the Dúnedain, but the Barrow White ultimately, I mean, again, it has its origin in this darkness which has come over the land and these evil spirits who enter into these tombs. The tombs weren't always like this. This is not like the unquiet dead, like the Dúnedain have spontaneously risen from their graves or anything. They were fine. The Dúnedain, that is, were fine. They were dead. They were like comfortably dead. To me, the most interesting and revealing thing that we get about the Barrow, the one glimpse that we are actually given of Barrow Whitish existence from the first person standpoint, is the incantation that the Barrow White sings over the bodies of Merry and Pippin and Sam. This is on 138. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone, nevermore to wake on stony bed, never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. In the black wind the stars shall die, and still on gold here let them lie, till the dark lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land. Cold be hand and heart and bone. So this is an incantation. He is saying this to the hobbits, like this is what he's going to do to the hobbits. It's a command. Cold be hand. It's in the subjunctive. Cold be hand and heart and bone, and cold be sleep under stone. In other words, he is dooming them to be corpses, sort of. Never more to wake on stony bed. Never till the sun fails and the moon is dead. And that they'll still be lying there on gold when the stars die in the black wind. That is, when the Dark Lord lifts his hand over dead sea and withered land, until the Dark Lord wins, which, of course, the Barrow White thinks is going to happen. Spoiler, it's not going to happen.
Now, I always wondered, the Dark Lord is ambiguous in a sense, because it could refer all the way back to Morgoth, because yes. Morgoth is supposed to make a return eventually.
Right.
And he was the one that was all big into, you know, let's kill the sun and the moon and the two trees and all that. So
yes. Yes. I too take the Dark Lord there as meaning Morgoth, not Sauron. Of course, no human being reading the Lord of the Rings when it first came out could possibly know that, because no one had ever heard of Morgoth. But I do think that that's what Tolkien meant when he wrote that. Yes, I mean, we have basically the Barrow White wishing death or a death-like state upon the hobbits in particular, and upon the world as a whole, in general, over the Dead Sea and Withered Land. This is sort of the goal. And you know, the way that I've always taken this, I mean, the emphasis that seems to me important here is that the Barrow White is essentially trying to make them like him. And I don't think the Barrow White is like especially, like the Barrow White isn't accomplishing anything here. Yeah, I mean, like basically it's just like, I see warm, living, happy creatures, and I want to bring them in and make them dead. In some ways, Here's cool. I never thought of this before. In some ways, it's like the opposite of dragons. And I've been thinking about this because we've been talking about this in the Mythgard class. We've just been talking about dragons, various dragons with Tolkien and with and Fafnir, who became a dragon in the Old Norse legends, who was the precursor to Tolkien's dragons in many ways. And of course, the way that but basically the principle here is the one which C.S. Lewis illustrates so clearly in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. That is when Eustace becomes a dragon. That sort of the standard dragon model is that you become dragonish by acting like a dragon. So, you know, you have the desire for the so basically we've got two instances where we've got a grave that's full of gold. Okay. Or like you've got like a big pile of gold. If you go into the pile of gold voluntarily and seek to possess it, you become dragonish. But that's not what is going on here with the Barrowites. He is bringing them in by force and condemning them to sit upon the gold. Mm-hmm. Not in a dragon. So it becomes their tomb, not their hoard. They don't, like Eustace, turn into a dragon. Instead, they turn into, will they become whites? Will they be, you know, Barrowites? Will they become, you know, will they become wraiths? Will they just die? I'm not sure ultimately what's going to happen to them if Frodo doesn't wake up and call in the quite unusual cavalry that is Tom Bombadil. But anyway, what the Barrow White is doing is he is making them like himself. And I don't think he enjoys it. I mean, what it sounds like to me, the way I've always taken his incantation is basically, this is my world. This is my existence. The inside mm-hmm. of this tomb and the cold gold and the empty life and the darkness. And I'm going to take you bright, happy, warm, living things, and I'm going to make you like me, miserable like me, shadowed and darkened and cold like me. And in fact, I look forward to the day when the whole world is like that. When everything is like me and is as miserable as I am. Anyway, that seems to be kind of the direction that the Barrow White.
Right.
So who were the Barrow Whites originally though? Where did they come from?
Well, see, I think they've been like sent here. I mean, the darkness comes and the evil spirits enter the tombs. That's a word that's used to describe it. They enter the tombs, like voluntarily, recreationally. I'm not sure. I don't think so. What's their purpose? What's their point? They don't.
Yeah.
You know, we never
and
see
why,
them. Being,
why those yeah. tombs in particular?
Yeah. Well,
why not the tombs? The mounds of the Rohirrim.
Yeah. 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 Well, I mean. They seem to be associated with the Witch King and the whole evil movement in the north of Middle Earth there.
Yeah, I always thought that they came from Angmar.
Yep.
I guess
yep,
just because right. of proximity.
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
But like you said, it seems to have a different agenda because it shows no interest in the ring at all.
Right.
You would think it would sense something like that on Frodo, but it really yeah. is kind of, you know, I guess is task orientated where it's like, okay, we're going to make you into these corpses and I'm going to do this and the other stuff really doesn't matter sort of thing.
Yes. Yes. I agree. I mean, they're not deployed militarily by Angmar. It seems, and again, this is one of the things that leads me to read his incantation in the way that I do, is that it seems like the only thing that is accomplished by the entrance of the evil spirits into these barrows is the taking of, basically, like it's like taking ground, right? This was the burial ground of the good guys. You know, these were good and noble people who were buried here, who are being commemorated here, and their grave places, their very memories, even their very bones, are being taken over by evil and being made into a place of evil. kind of
like a desecration or corruption.
Exactly. Kind of like Minas Ithil into Minas Morgul. We're going to take something that's good, that's, you know, sort of powerful for good, and we're going to turn it into evil. And because it's not obvious that any use is ever made of the Barrow Whites. So now the graves that are there are haunted, like, you know, mission accomplished, guys. Like, now what are you going to do? Well, like they're never deployed so far as we can tell. But that doesn't seem to be the point of them. The point of them is basically just like corruption, the corruption of evil. We're going to spread this darkness and death, and this attitude of darkness and death, because that's what the Barrow White does. You know, you come near my Barrow, and I'm going to assimilate you into the my world of darkness and evil and corruption.
Well, you're right. That is a theme later on. You know, we see it with Treebeard talking about how the orcs, you know, they just came and cut down trees for no purpose. They didn't burn them or anything or use them. They just cut them down. And then just the desolation that Sauron seems to leave behind him in Mordor, the pits filled with muck and vapors, that there's no purpose to them. They're just, you know, filth left out there to corrupt the land.
Right. So. Right. Yes, exactly. No, and I think that there are some similar things that we can see in common. There's actually, I think we can see some common threads among several of the things that people suggested that we talk about tonight. The Barrow Whites are in that way, you know, like that kind of corruption, like Mirkwood, right? The corruption of Greenwood the Great into Mirkwood, and just sort of the spreading of this evil and darkness, and not just darkness, but literal blackness, like the animals turn black in Mirkwood. And the desolation of Smaug, and, you know, the blasted state of the land around the Black Gate, and the dead marshes. Like, all of these things are things which have been twisted and corrupted for no purpose, you know, for no real strategic reason, but just as a byproduct. Like, it's what evil does, is destroy things, is twist things, is pervert things. That's the very nature of evil, is a good thing that is twisted and perverted. And that's what evil creatures do. So that, I mean, it's not with the White, again, I don't think with the Barrow White it's strategic. I don't think he's got a plan. I don't think he's got a purpose. He just wants to. But then that's why
just
Mary's
evil,
memory
huh?
is so fascinating. Is that Mary? Well, yeah, you know, yeah, exactly. Just, you know, generic evil. But that's why Mary's memory is so fascinating. Is that Mary's memory? I'm not sure. I mean, certainly it's a product of him having been under the spell of the Barrow White, but it's not obvious to me that Mary's memory is a direct result of the Barrow White spell, in the sense of, like, the Barrow White gave him that dream, because the dream that he had was the memory of the good guy who was buried there. And I'm not sure, and I still don't know what to do with that. I mean, I find that passage really kind of tantalizing, and I'm not sure how to take it or where to take it exactly. You know, if Mary somehow, like, was in touch with, in some sense, you know, the spirit of the guy who was buried there, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what to do with it, but it's really fascinating.
Hey, so one comment that came up a while ago in the chat room is, what's the difference between the Whites and the dudes that are in the Marshes of the Dead, or the Dead Marshes?
Yeah, that's a good question. yeah, they are different. Well, for one thing, go ahead, Laura.
Weren't the people in the Dead Marshes people who had been killed in the Battle of the Last Alliance, elves and men, mm-hmm. who had been killed, and that was their spirits, although I don't know why they would be unquiet spirits.
Yes, exactly. No, the mechanism...
Unless something similar is coming from Mordor,
right,
and sort of making them evil.
I mean, the mechanism of the Dead Marshes is not very clear. I mean, is never really explained.
Doesn't that take from some of the folk tales about lights and swamps and, and marshes and things like that?
Yes, it does. I mean, the tradition of wisps and fairy lights and things like that in marshes. That's a very well established tradition, and he is kind of working with that within the world of Middle Earth. It's not very clear kind of what's going on there. I mean, obvious differences between the dead things, the dead faces, in the marshes, and the Barrow-wites is that, first of all, they don't seem to have any corporeal being, as Gollum says, only to see and not to touch, because he tried, right? As Sam darkly speculates, Gollum probably tried to eat them at one point and failed. So he says that, Sam shudders to think of why Gollum was trying to reach them, and he's clearly implying that he thinks Gollum was trying to eat the corpses. But anyway, he couldn't do it. You know, only shapes to see, not to touch, says Gollum. And certainly they appear to be right under the surface, but they're not tangible. So first of all, they don't have bodies. Barrow-wites do have bodies. Frodo hacks one of their hands off. So clearly they have corporeal bodies. So that's one obvious difference. They also do things like move and talk and sing creepy songs. So, and that also clearly the things and the faces in the dead marshes don't have. They seem to be completely inert. They seem to be just visual representations. They don't seem to be animate at all. They seem to be a memory, and or a memory or a memorial. And what I would connect them with generally, like the other places in Tolkien's works that I would connect them with, actually have nothing to do with death at all, but ways in which places seem to have memories in Tolkien's world. Remember the passage when in the Fellowship of the Ring, when the Fellowship is traveling south from Rivendell and they're going through Eregion, through the land of Holland, and Legolas speaks of like how the stones remember the elves that live there. Deep they delved us, high they builded us, but they are gone. They are gone. The land remembers the elves that live there. And this kind of animism, this kind of like the sense that like locations have particular kind of spirits, or memories, is that we see this come up in a bunch of places. Even like, the Old Forest. The Old Forest keeps grudges, against the hobbits for burning,
for the bonfire. For
the bonfire, yeah, exactly.
I thought Legolas was just being, kind of sentimental. I didn't think he really literally meant.
There are several passages like that, it could just be poetical, right? I mean, he could just be speaking sort of figuratively or something. But there are a bunch of times like that. So for me, the Dead Marshes is one of the biggest examples of this, that the land here has been scarred by the battle that was there and all of the corpses, the thousands of corpses that were buried there. And it remembers, so it's like the land remembers the dead. The marshes have grown since the battle, says Gollum, and has swallowed up the graves. But the corpses aren't there. The corpses are gone. The corpses have disintegrated. But it's like the marshes themselves, the land itself, still remembers the battle, still remembers the bodies, still remembers the dead. And so they are kind of commemorated in this way.
So it's just haunted, in other words.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But not haunted by the spirits of the dead themselves. The spirits of the dead are presumably not involved at all. That is why I think the faces in the dead marshes appear to be completely inanimate and not sentient. This is why, by the way, I'm not a big fan of the dead marshes sequence in the film, because it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I mean, like, okay, it's like spookier, you know, and if the dead faces never moved or did anything, it would look much more lame on film. So I can kind of understand why they did it. I mean, like, it's cool and everything, but from a thematic standpoint, it doesn't make all that much sense to me. Why would there be spirits of the dead who are still there? Because we don't see that happening. We don't see, like, routine hauntings in Tolkien. That is, like, the spirit of a dead person who comes back to, you know, haunt the place where they lived or something like that. Or the place where they died or like that. I can't think of any examples of that kind
of
haunting.
Yeah, we just have the Oathbreakers, but they're obviously a special case.
Right, exactly. They're being held there by Isildur's curse. So, yeah, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's not... there is not that kind of routine haunting. And so therefore, again, yeah, so no, they're not really there. The spirits of the dead, I don't think we have any reason to think the spirits of the dead are actually there in the dead marshes. But interestingly, the one piece of activity, again, like the Barrow-wights, Gollum suggests that perhaps, you know, if the hobbits go down to join the dead ones, they would light little candles of their own, right? So they're like, they will assimilate you. But not like the Barrow-wights again, because there's not that kind of active force behind it. There's no intention behind it. The Barrow-wights are actively seeking to assimilate living things into their world of coldness and death and darkness. The Dead Marshes, they're actually a growing place. You know, there's you know, as the narrator suggests, like, at least in the Dead Marshes, there's still like pond scum and stuff. Good, healthy, green pond scum compared to the desolation before the Black Gates. But anyway, it really seems to be, as I say, the memories of the dead. And I don't know who else's memories it could be, if not the land itself.
Could it be like a window into the past a little bit, the surface of the water?
Yeah, I mean, possibly in that sense, that we're getting a glimpse, you know, that in some way, the water has become this kind of window into the memory of the land or something. I mean, in some sense. But again, certainly, like, did Sauron make it? I don't see why. I mean, I don't see what the point is. There's, it doesn't do anything. I mean, again, it serves even less point than the Barrow-wights serve. It's just, especially since the memory of the good guys is not corrupt. I mean, like, that is, when Frodo describes seeing them, he describes seeing, you know, the elves with noble faces and sad. You know, they're not twisted. They're not corrupted. They're, you know, I mean, they're dead. They're rotten. They're corpses. But they're still good corpses. So, I don't know.
It just seems like a more of a memory imprinted on the place that,
yeah,
that doesn't necessarily have to do anything with what Sauron was trying to achieve, just something that came about because of the fact that so many people struggled and died there, and yeah, thus even the orcs are still in there, and they're not, you know, I think all of them, the men, the elves and the orcs are described as, you know, that sadness look.
Yep. No, exactly. I mean, and that's how I take the Dead Marshes and why I think the specters, or whatever you want to call them, that are in the marshes are very different from the Barrow-wights, who are very different from the Nazgul, and who have nothing to do with vampires because they're not bats. There we are.
Went all the way back to the beginning.
Perfect.
That's right. Yeah. See how I tied all that together there?
Well done, sir.
We actually got to almost everything. We didn't talk about spiders, but
Let me tell you, just on the point of spiders. So last Friday, as some of you know, I was over at Warner Brothers Interactive Entertainment, getting a private demo of the new Lord of the Rings game that comes out tomorrow.
Yeah,
Lord of the Rings War in the North. That's right. Or wait. The Lord of the Rings, colon, War in the North.
War in the North. Yes. That's right. So you got to get your articles right.
Yes. And one of the stages they let us play was Mirkwood. And I got to tell you, if you have even a touch of arachnophobia, it's horrifying. It's really terrifying. Oh gosh, it's pretty bad. Let me tell you. Oh, yeah. And also, Corey, I just got to say, the game's significantly harder when you're not when you don't have unending life.
What you mean, like when the bad guys actually hurt you?
Yes.
When they make contact.
Those little guys
would make it harder.
The little guys running around who blow up—they do a lot of damage. So, but yeah,
man, that was awful.
The spiders are horrendous, and I was just thinking that's going to be a really scary scene in The Hobbit, or it could be.
Yes.
If
it should be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. If the CGI sucks, then it'll be stupid. But actually, it'll be that, you know, George, it'll be that perfect juxtaposition of horror and humor that that we were talking about earlier, because it'll be like this terrifying scene with these giant scary spiders, and then hopefully Martin Freeman bobbing around singing the old Fat Spider song.
Yeah, if Martin Freeman does not say Attercop and old Tom Noddy, I'm going to be really upset. Like, I'm sorry. Like, I'm not going to leave the theater, but I'm going to be mad if the word Attercop is not said by Martin Freeman. Like, I'm sorry. You got to have standards, and that's, you know, I'm sorry. I got to stand for that.
Will you storm out?
I won't storm out. I will control myself, but I will complain bitterly about it afterwards forever.
I would like to say that would mean that would make an excellent YouTube video. you jumping up in the middle of the film, shouting some kind of indistinguishable profanity, and then running out shouting "Attercop, Attercop."
Well, no, I would just have to supply the Attercop or Tom Noddy myself.
Even better, rather than storming out, just run down to the front and start singing the song.
Exactly.
That'd be like a live action Hobbit as opposed to, you know, live action Rocky Horror. So
it's fine. That was kind of like I have to choose very very patient and long suffering people to go see these movies with. Like, the people who saw the Lord of the Rings movies in the theater with me were very patient, because I mean, it's like there are enough quotations that, you know, I like was quoting along with parts of the movie the first time that I saw it, which is a strange experience to have, like to, and then of course it would throw me for a loop, you know, when they would quote things just like in completely different contexts. But the other thing is that they would give most of a quote and stop, and like, and then I would like
finish it,
you know, like when Théoden, before the battle of Pelennor Fjord, it's like, you know, as I said, "For Lord and land," and then he stops, and so I, you know, shouted "And League of Friendship," but everyone looked at me and was like, "What is wrong with this guy?"
Well, if it makes you feel any better, the people who watched The Lord of the Rings with me no longer will watch The Lord of the Rings with me.
I don't even watch the movies, but that's a whole nother subject.
Well, it's because now I'm looking forward to The Hobbits, but I'm telling you, I don't know anything about the script, but the word Attercop better be in it. That's all I have to say. But you're right. I mean, certainly it's one of the things that's going on in the book is the poise between horror and humor there. Mm-hmm. I mean, Tolkien is pretty careful there, as in other places. He's very, very delicate in poising those two things and not backing off from it. I mean, having genuinely horrifying things there, but not making it simply overwhelmingly horrifying. And you know, even to not just the lines like the you know, Bilbo song and stuff, but even in some of the descriptions, like the comparison when Bilbo kicks the spider, comparing it to the sound that it makes when you kick a flabby football and stuff, you know, like a lot of the language that he uses, or the comparison of the dwarves to like toys bobbing on a wire and things. Mm-hmm. You know, he uses several funny and lighthearted and childish, that is like things associated with the play of children, language throughout that scene, which does a really good job of diffusing it while still retaining the like seriousness and horror of the situation. But yeah, on screen, that's going to be pretty intense. And the thing is like, if you're going to do what I suspect, okay, here's a Fearless prediction. I think he's going to, he being Peter Jackson, is going to downplay Bilbo's heroism in that scene. Because that's the moment in the book when Bilbo starts kicking butt and taking names. I mean, giving names, I guess, to his sword. But he just like takes over and starts beating the crap out of spiders. And if Peter Jackson does a full like creepy arachnophobic spider thing there, and then has Bilbo coming in and just like mowing them down with his sword and with his rocks, like all of a sudden Bilbo is going to look like, you know, an action hero. He turns into an action hero in the book. And my fearless prediction is that Bilbo is not going to turn into an action hero in the movie. I think that he's going to be more bumbling and comical still.
Oh man.
Yeah. Well,
just a guess. But it's a guess based upon the general trends that we can see in the Lord of the Rings films, where they are continually reducing the heroism and sort of stature of characters.
I think I'm gonna go against you on that one, because yeah? I think they'll do something a little more like what they did with Frodo and Sam. You know, they did get more heroic. I mean, Frodo was kind of depressed from the beginning, but you know, yeah. Sam especially did get more heroic in the movies. I think they will. I think they will make Frodo the hero, because who else are you going to really focus on as the hero except Bard, maybe, and he won't have that much film time, I doubt, but
right.
So I think they'll make Bilbo somewhat of a hero. I mean, I don't know if they'll go really that far, you know, making him a superhero or anything, but I think he'll kick some butt against those spiders. I think that'd be cool. I'd like to see that.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to it. And of course, then the real question is, are the spiders going to be in the first film or the second film? Where is the break in films going to be? That's one of the big mysteries.
I personally
I'm going to make another prediction. I think they're going to have Tom Bombadil in this. I think they're really sorry they didn't have him in the first film.
Oh yeah,
I think he's going to make an appearance. So.
Singing Addercop.
Exactly. I'm sure Peter Jackson's sitting around saying, you know, man, and we have these. We have these perfectly good yellow boots sitting around that we didn't get to use in the last films. You know, I know.
Well, you know, Tom Bombadil. Bombadil fits in pretty well with the spirit of the Hobbit. You know, even, you know,
it's
rather
true.
Than drinks. So.
He'll be on a road trip visiting Bard when they stop by.
There you go.
It's quite possible. It's quite unlikely, actually, but it will be interesting to see. I mean, I don't know where they're going to break it. My guess would be my prediction for where the midpoint in the films is going to be is the House of Beorn. I think the spiders are going to be in the second film. That we're going to end with. I think they're going to beef up. You know, when in the book, when Bjorn goes off stage and goes over and tracks down the goblins and wargs and like captures the two of them and tortures them until they talk and then like rips off their heads. I think that part, which all happens off screen, I think that part is going to be pretty beefed up. I think we're going to get like a Bjorn action scene. Remember all those bears that come and hang out around Bjorn's house at night and don't ever do anything? I think in the films they're going to fix that, and those bears are going to like come into action. I think we're going to get a goblin Bjorn little skirmish there at the end of the first movie as like a foreshadowing of the Battle of Five Armies that's going to happen at the end.
I don't think that would bother me very much. I think I would be okay with that.
Yeah. I think they're going to end it when the eagles rescue the hobbit and the dwarves.
Wait, that's so early.
To end with the eagles are coming?
It's not that early, because Bilbo has the ring, and that's sort of a foreshadowing of what happens at the last army. And that's a nice eucatastrophe to end the first film on. So there's my prediction. Eagles.
Okay.
We'll see.
They're going to end, Corey, they're going to end with hitting the magical button combination.
Exactly. The eucatastrophe button. So useful. Except, of course, it really does go against the definition of eucatastrophe.
When you snap it on.
Act of sudden grace, which can't be counted on to recur, unless you hit the right button combination on your Xbox controller, in which case you can count on it every time. So it does take a little something away from you, catastrophe. But anyway, it's still pretty cool.
It should be a button that only works randomly.
Yes. See, that's how I would totally do it. Like, you could do this button, and there's like a random chance. You know, there's like a certain degree of chance that it will work every time you do it. That's totally how they should have. Oh, what a missed opportunity. Instead of just having like a certain number of like feathers or whatever to use to summon the eagle, you should have like any time during the game you can summon the eagle, but it probably won't work. But sometimes,
yeah, one in a million chance.
One of these times it works. That would be fantastic. Oh man. Okay. Well,
just don't tell me they're a taxi service in that game.
I don't know. I don't know. But I mean, they're a taxi service in The Hobbit, I guess. So you know, it works. All right.
Well,
all right.
It's getting late on the East Coast. We should probably wrap it up.
It is getting late on the East Coast. We should. So, well, thanks, everybody. This has been a fun conversation, and we will sign off now. We'll try to get this episode out here for everybody who missed the first part of it due to technical failures and to people who couldn't make it. I had one listener who lives in England who was threatening to stay up for this, and I was like, Andy, you're insane. But anyway, so I don't know if, Andy, if you stayed up, congratulations. If not, I'm kind of glad, and you'll still get a chance to hear this.
I believe he's in there.
Is he? Oh, my goodness. Andy's incredible.
Lunatic.
He was in Mythgard class, too, I think. So.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, that was a great show, and thank you to everybody who was in the chat room. It was an awesome chat room tonight.
Yeah, that's great. We should see if can you save a transcript of it?
I think I can probably do that.
Dave, is that possible? See if you can save a transcript of it, and we'll see if I can post that somewhere, maybe on my website or something.
That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It looks like I think I can. Yep, the entire thing's in there. Copy.
Awesome. Cool. Cool. Good.
Paste. Then so we need to do more of these live events, Corey.
Yeah, that would be fun.
Hate to commit you to it, but
I've been wanting to do, and several people were sort of hoping that we'd be able to do some live Skype call-in tonight, which I decided just to kind of simplify things and do that later on, because I mean I've done Skype call-in sessions before, but that was before the advent of Middle Earth Network Radio. So now we can do live call-in shows with the chat room and everything. So
right on.
Live broadcast rather than just having people talk to me and
yes.
be recorded. So
and letting people interact in the chat room too. So
yeah, no, that's great.
And
so no, we should definitely do that. So when I do, so that will be my plan. When I do call-in sessions from now on, we'll do them in this live format. And I hope to do one of those soon. I'm not going to commit myself to exactly when that's going to happen because I'm not sure. But I would definitely
smart move.
Yeah. But I would want to do that sooner rather than later.
Yeah. And George, thanks for jumping on at the last second. Same to you, Laura, too. Thank you guys both for getting last-minute notice to do this.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for letting me be on.
Absolutely. I hope George, hopefully one of these days soon, Corey can have you on and do like a Tolkien chat episode with you so the listeners can hear more from you. And Laura, it was wonderful to hear your voice on the – I mean, I'm not listening to the podcast, but it was wonderful to do this with you again. I missed the Silmarillion seminar days.
I know. I just don't know what to do with myself on Wednesday nights anymore.
Well, I guess we need to get our butts in gear on the new seminar and on the Silmarillionaires.
Yep. Yeah, that's right.
That's right.
Yes. All right.
Well, night, everyone.
I'll let it go. Yep.
Okay. Yes. Good night, everybody.
Yep. Night. Thank you for listening, everybody, and thank you to all of our guests. And Corey, I'm going to let you take us away.
Okay. Thanks for listening, and Godspeed.